Hello, I'm Susan Florey, and this is The Big Middle, my podcast exploring the big issues of longer midlife, rethinking aging in a world obsessed with youth. My sponsor this week is Five-A-Side Chess, a social enterprise here in the UK tackling the epidemic of loneliness and social isolation by bringing the generations together over a game of chess. So many of us hit a career wall at halftime. Circumstances force change, or we actively seek it. Even when chucked out due to retrenchment or evil ageism, many 50-somethings experience an irresistible urge to do something completely different. After 32 years turning out much-loved columns mocking the madness of corporate life, Financial Times journalist Lucy Kellaway took her craving for new and different to the school gates. But not before she met her partner in reinvention, Katie Walgrave, a former teacher and social entrepreneur with a PhD in creative writing and matching zeal for purposeful disruption. Lucy and Katie launched Now Teach, a pioneering movement creating a path for people with decades of experience to retrain as teachers. We're sitting comfortably now at Now Teach HQ in leafy Bloomsbury Square, central London. Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, hello.
Now you know who's who. Let's begin with what must be a delicious memory. You shared it with me. You each cradling one of your newborns, Katie, in the summer of 2016. Your madcap idea coming to life, Lucy.
Yeah, so I had this idea that all of these people in their 50s, they're all fed up with their jobs, and quite a lot of them might want to retrain as teachers. I was sort of banging on about this idea at a party to this woman who I knew dimly, who happened to be Katie's mother. And she said, "My daughter, this is really interesting. Go and talk to my daughter about this." So I emailed Katie and I found myself in Shepherd's Bush. Katie, whose babies were what, 3 months, I think? Or even younger.
Or possibly a bit less.
These were about June. Yeah. Tiny, beautiful babies.
And we got to talking about Belinda Grattan and Andrew Scott's book and the 100-year life thing, and statistically, apparently, both these babies were more likely to live longer, and Lucy wanted to become a teacher, and obviously Lucy should become a teacher. And it just seemed like we should just try and do it, which, looking back, wasn't entirely a rational way of launching.
You became almost instantly a Pied Piper, trying to get everyone to follow you, Lucy. And you shared that your colleagues thought you were crazy to jack in your job. You were a hugely popular columnist for the prestigious FT, but you were resolute. You were going to be a maths teacher.
I think some did and some didn't, actually. I think that the ones who felt wedded to what they were doing felt that if I had the cheek to say, "This means nothing to me anymore," that was actually quite threatening to them.
Right. Natural response, yeah. Too. They just think, well, you're diminishing the value of what we do.
Yes, exactly. What do you mean you're giving all of this up? Saying, "Nah, don't want to do this anymore." But I think equally there were quite a few others who sort of thought, "God, I'd love to do that as well."
You can't keep doing the same thing all the time without blowing a vein.
No, and actually in the couple of years that have followed, there have been two or three people from the FT who have applied to Now Teach. So,
oh, fantastic.
So, and I hope there'll be many more behind them.
Now, the FT's going to be thrilled.
She's raiding the place. Now, crazy is a word, too, that might be used to describe what you were thinking back in the summer of 2016. Three-month-old, newborn twins. Such an ambitious gambit. Did you ever think, "I'm nuts to be taking this on"?
I just think we thought it was worth a go. I mean, we imagined we might get half a dozen people, 12 people that first year. It would be a very sort of small-scale experiment, just see if it was even plausible. Maybe Lucy was actually the only mad person. It didn't seem likely, but maybe we weren't going to find lots of people interested. We also thought that lots of people would take a long time to think about it, so that we didn't imagine it would take off quickly, even if it
But you were inundated
off.
Right, really, from the start.
Remember that first morning, the website crashed. You got sort of scooped on your own story, didn't you?
Yeah.
You were meant to be writing about it in the FT, that Monday column, but it kind of got scooped by...
by The Guardian, and I was standing there in my pyjamas on a Sunday morning.
Trying to cook brunch for my entire extended family, and the website...
And so what, it was
crashed.
Breaking news, Lucy Kellaway leaving the FT.
I was just looking at my phone and on Twitter... and this was sort of trending, which seemed so weird and so bizarre and kind of emotional. Because I'd announced that I was going in November, but I wasn't going to actually leave the FT till the summer.
Right.
And I kind of thought, no one in the world would care about this apart from me, because one woman leaves her job, so what? But it suddenly became real to me with these just outpouring pouring on social networks.
So what was it? A reporter had heard you quietly discussing it sotto voce at a party? Or?
It was I mean, this is all, you know, journalists love other journalists. And this was the Guardian's media editor. He ran the story first because, you know, I had been at the FT longer than anyone apart from the editor himself. So yeah. I guess me leaving marked the end of an era in a way.
1985?
Yeah, 1985,
yes. It was a long time.
It was a very long time. But, you know, it was very, very weird. And then suddenly from that, all of these other people thinking, my goodness, that's what I want to do too. And as Katie said, our website crashed and the applications were pouring in. We didn't know what to do with them. We didn't employ anybody. We didn't know.
We were calling them ourselves. We found the wonderful Becca, but very, you know,
So you're literally on your mobile phones calling all of these people saying, oh, we're just not that organised yet, but we will get there.
I hope we sounded mad. Yeah, we didn't quite acknowledge how disorganised we were, perhaps.
Did you have a space at HQ like this?
No, we were sitting in sort of cafe of another organisation, but we did tell people they would be making it up as they went along, and this was all an experiment. And people kind
but
of
how exciting, how exhilarating
that,
that is! Because
it was a sort of new thing they were doing.
Yeah,
you're tapping into what 50-somethings want if they want to change and find purpose and all of that.
Yeah.
So the first year you had how many applicants then?
So we had about 1,000 people filled in forms suggesting that they were interested. And of those, quite a lot were fantasists, I think. They just sort of thought, oh, yes, and then sort of had second thoughts the next minute. And then
spoke to their wives. Their
But
did they all have to be successful high flyers in their current career?
No, we wanted people who made... I mean, in a way, what you want to be able to do is to take to the school somebody who can show to students something of the world beyond. That was the point, I guess. So, no, they were very successful, and many of them are. But success has all kinds of different ways of being judged.
Well, take us through the process, then, of evaluation, assessment, because, you know, from saying, putting your hand up and saying, I want to do that, to getting in front of the class, it doesn't happen in a week.
No, and the biggest, most important thing we realised very quickly was they had to really want to do it, and they had to know what it was, what they might be letting themselves in for. I mean, those remain the two really crucial.
I think those are still the two things, because if you're a perfectly intelligent person and you have searched your soul long and hard and you really want to do it and you know what it's like being in a classroom, there's almost nothing else that can go wrong.
No.
I mean, you know, all the other stuff is sort of dotting the I's and crossing the T's, really. Part of that you do, in addition, need to really like teenagers.
Well, I had to laugh because I was reading one of your updates to the FT, because you've been keeping everybody well aware of how it's been going. And you said that one guy who was really keen in his first assessment, he was found sleeping at the back of the class.
Yes, actually, we never even took him on. He went to one of our schools to get some school experience.
Right.
First of all, he was sitting at the back of the classroom on his mobile phone, which is a complete no-no.
Oh, my word.
And then nodded off in some point.
What a wonderful example for the children. Yeah.
So
he didn't make it to assessment.
No, we saw no more of him.
Yeah. Knowing what it is the crucial thing. So one of our jobs is to help people figure out, you know, if they really do want it, and what will it be like, and to spend time in schools and to understand.
So you almost have to be a psychological therapist. You've got to be sitting them down and making sure that they know exactly what it is. So tell me then, if I apply tomorrow, what's the process?
So if you apply tomorrow, you probably start by filling out just a short EOI form on our website. And if you look great, which obviously you would, we'll get back to you as quickly as possible, encouraging you to fill out the application form. But in that time, you might want lots of conversations. You might want to know details of, you know, what the school day is like, and we can talk to you about that. Or you might say, you know, you went to school in Canada, what do we do about your certificates, and we can guide you through the
God, lost in the mist of time, mine.
Yeah. And of course, most people over the age of 22, their certificates are lost in the mist of time. So we're quite good at kind of helping navigate all those sort of slightly bureaucratic things.
So it's not, you know, hard formed criteria. It's an ad hoc assessment, and you can more or less initially the call is.
There's a requirement around qualifications. So you need a degree, you need to have maths and English GCSE or O level equivalent from whatever country. But beyond that,
those are government requirements. So we make sure that people meet those. And then we interview them, and we are looking for sort of fairly obvious things. You need to be able to communicate. You need to be tough. If you're not tough, you're not going to make it.
But how do you measure the kind of grit that's needed?
Honestly, you can't.
Yeah.
You do as well or as badly as any other interview. You know, you ask people, to sort of, you know, there's grim things about think of a time when you've shown you're resilient and you listen to their answers and you think, do I buy that or not? So we do screening that weeds out the people who are going to be obviously hopeless. And we take the people who we really believe in. But even then, the final decision is not made by us because we don't employ them. It's made by the schools. So we have done this screening. We present our candidates who we think are fabulous to the schools, and the schools take the decision based on a lesson that they have to give to a live class of children.
So they get the support of the school, and it's the ARC Academy Network,
it's
the
a whole
educational
range of different schools. Okay. We started with ARC. They were our sort of founding partner, if you like,
right.
And we're now working with lots and lots of different schools and training providers.
So they wouldn't be thrown in the deep end and said, come up with a lesson right now on trigonometry.
They would for the assessment. Part of a school interview process involves a trial lesson. But once they're accepted on the programme, no, on the first day, they're not expected to teach any lessons. They will observe for a little bit, and after a couple of weeks, they might be given a class, and they'd be doing 5 lessons a week, and then through the course of the training year, it builds up, so they might be teaching 14 or 15 hours a week by the end of the year.
Do some of the best candidates bomb out almost immediately?
I feel like we're getting better, even in the first 2 years at sort of judging those things. And I do, again, think so much of it is about, you know, it's all very well us trying to judge who is resilient, but the more they know what kind of resilience it is they're going to need, what will the year look like, the more they're able to self-select. So, you know, we've had some surprises. We've had people who we assumed were just going to absolutely fly, perhaps struggle more than we'd expected. And we've had people who we sort of hoped were going to be brilliant, be utterly stunning. And
yeah, because you can perform in one setting, in a corporate presentation with your PowerPoint slides, and do really well. But get you in front of what? What's the average class size? 30?
Yeah, about 30, yeah.
Yeah, 30 kids who are all, you haven't earned their respect yet, and they're looking for answers from you and some learning. That'd be terrifying.
So among the other things that we're specifically looking for are humility. So if you come in with, you know, I'm used to sort of telling everyone what to do, that's probably not going to work.
Actually, the fact that you say that you'd be terrified is already a good starting point. Of course it's terrifying.
You said after your first few months teaching maths, Lucy, that you called it brutal but joyous. Let's look at both of those descriptives. Brutal, why?
Okay, it's brutal. It's relentless and it's entirely unforgiving. So there is no other job in which you make your mistakes daily and live in front of 32 kids who are not necessarily on your side.
And are they scrutinising you all the time?
Yeah, they think it's absolutely hilarious, anything you do that sort of shows that you're a novice. So I was, I still struggle with the technology, so that makes me look an instant idiot.
Well, what technology do you mean?
Well, I mean, you teach with slides, which might be PowerPoint, or even more terrifying, smart notebook, which is an interactive thing you do on the whiteboard. You touch the whiteboard by mistake, gesturing, your slides go mental. How do you get them back again? The class is getting fractious, you're in a slight panic. Oops,
oh,
you hit the wrong button.
And they just think, oh, comedy hour.
Yes, exactly, they think comedy hour. So that's quite brutal. The multitasking is the most stressful thing I've ever done before, because it's not just you're managing the technology, you're trying to keep an eye on 32 individuals, some of whom may be understanding what you're saying, some of whom won't have a clue. You're also trying to remember, oh my goodness, you must set homework, you must do this, you've got to do that. There are so many different things in your head at any given time, and you're trying to supply the correct answers on the board to whatever problem you've
so
laid
grueling.
Out. So it's
grueling.
Very, very,
yeah.
And then the bell rings, and then you do the whole thing over again.
And then you have to go out and be recess guard as well, you know, when
yes,
they're
so
out playing in the
playground. Yeah. But so, you know, as Katie says, the bell rings, and oh my goodness, they haven't packed up in time. They're going to be late for their next lesson. By the time you've escorted them out of the classroom and got to the other side of the school where your next lesson is, the next class is lining up outside.
So there's no slack in the system at all. It sounds like caregivers going from patient to patient to patient, no same regimen.
And there's no time to go to the loo either.
You're kidding.
No, you can't go to the loo.
Well, mind you, in television news, there's very little time either. So, it's, you know, I used to call it battery journalism farming because that's what it felt like. Deadline, deadline, deadline. And you just think, loo, oh, maybe in an hour.
Yes.
Teachers develop strong bladders.
Yes.
Oh, my word. And the joyous aspect of the initial question.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very cheesy. The joy comes from the kids. And it is lovely working with people who are that young. And it's completely amazing feeling when you make them interested in something or when you make them learn something.
When they get it and it's because of you.
Yeah, when they get it. And, you know, the other day, a girl who had been thinking that she wanted to do drama came back saying that, no, now she's so interested in economics, which is what I now teach, she wants to go to a great university and do economics. And we were having a sort of long conversation about that. And to see her so sort of freshly excited was a really wonderful thing.
Oh,
absolutely
amazing.
Wonderful.
I read one of your columns, of course, in my preparation for this. And you were saying, you know, as an FD columnist, she got a lot of feedback, but it wasn't warm, fuzzy, personal.
Yeah, it doesn't, I mean, sometimes I'd write something that people enjoyed and they thought it was funny and that was sort of quite nice. But I think as a journalist, you become very numb to feedback because there's so much of it and you get hundreds of comments on everything. A lot of them are really, really unpleasant. So I'd stop reading it. So that the sort of feedback from journalists I felt kind of weird and slightly queasy about.
So this is immediate. You know you're making a difference.
This is real time. You can see the feedback on their faces. And that can be good and really bad. If you are boring them, then you have to be very alive to their feedback and take corrective action when necessary.
And I mean, you must have found that when you were teaching as well, Katie. What is the corrective action that you take to control children who are, some are bored, some are well slept and keen to go and ready to, you know, jump out of their chairs? What do you do?
I guess the answer is that's the graft of teaching. There is no one action. You've got to have a beautiful lesson plan. You've got to be compelling. You've got to won them over for the last past bit of time. You've got to know where to stand and have
stable of lame jokes.
You've got to make them laugh if you possibly can. I mean, it's the most complicated, fascinating profession there is. But I was thinking the feedback is live, but it's also delayed. I mean, I haven't. You know, I still will meet children who I was teaching in, say, when I first started teaching in 2003 or 2004, and they get in touch years later. And, you know, sometimes they're children you thought that you were really not doing a good job for them, and they'll remember you really fondly and say that you made some kind of a difference. And
I love that because I remember three teachers that made a difference to me.
Tell them.
And I will never. Yeah, I mean, gosh, where are they? A different country? Who knows? But, yeah, I mean, teachers can have a profound impact on your life.
My mother was a teacher, and she was a much, much loved teacher. And it always used to slightly irritate me when I was sort of, you know, maybe in my 40s, I would return to Camden, where I had grown up. And in M&S, I would bump into a former schoolmate of mine who were never interested to see me. They'd say, "Oh, Lucy, how are you? How's your mum?"
Bathed in glory.
Yeah,
how is she? Oh, my word. Well, I love this line. You wrote in one of your update FT columns that you were in a permanent state of agitation that's oddly reminiscent of being in love in the first months of brutal and joyous.
Okay, I think I'm probably past the infatuated stage. I think I may have written that on month two or three. I'm now coming towards the end of my second year. So I'd say my relationship with the job is not that sort of wild, crazy, wake up at 3 a.m. infatuation, but it's developing into something more loving and stable, just as every good relationship should.
More consistent and predictable.
More consistent, less incompatible with sleep, little bit duller, but none the worse for that.
Now, you're running things here at HQ, Katie, with a small team, let's call it. What, 9, 10 people?
No, we're more than that. I think we're about 15. But
oh, wow. Okay, I didn't count properly at all.
No, some people are not here today.
Are you inundated now with applicants? Is it sort of steady flow?
It's a steady flow. We could do with more. We want to grow. We want to, you know, expand. And this year we've started working not just in London and Hastings, where we've been, but also in the West Midlands and East Anglia. We're trying to recruit small sort of pilots there.
So you want to roll it out across the country?
And one of our sort of, I mean, London's an interesting case because there's always going to be a need for teachers, not least because it's hard to afford living in London. So there's a really sort of people start often teaching in London, but then move out.
You've got to be in that sweet spot position to maybe have paid off the mortgage and be able to afford to take a serious pay cut.
I suppose for starting it, that has been a really helpful thing for many people to be, at the stage of life where children have maybe moved out of home or, downsize the house, paid off the mortgage, that stuff. But I think in terms of expanding, what we really hope is that where we can almost be most useful is in the kind of rural coastal areas. It's famously difficult to recruit young teachers to go to some of those places if where they want to be is, say, London or Manchester or somewhere. But actually, our demographic either want to be there, are already there, or have been schlepping and commuting an hour and a half, turn around and go 10 minutes the other way.
Well, I can see the appeal. Can I put my hand up for something by the seaside?
Jeremy Hastings, how are you feeling about that?
Why not? It'd be wonderful. Now, you mentioned earlier you switched from maths. Now you're teaching business and economics. What happened there? Was it better fit?
Yeah, much better fit. So maths, I suppose I had this feeling that I'd loved it so much at school. I think maths matters so much. When you see people who have got a blockage over maths at school, it blights their lives, really. And so I had thought I can really try and help that. And what I actually found was that I didn't think I was ever going to be quite as good at maths as my 22-year-old colleagues, who were incredibly detail-orientated and sort of very well organised, and I'm miles more chaotic. But the real sadness was that I went into teaching wanting to share my experience that I've had over a longish life with the kids. You can't do that when you're teaching them simultaneous equations.
Right.
But in economics, which was my degree, and business studies, well, I've written about
business. You just empty your brain bank most days.
Every day. So it's a doddle, and it's delightful. It's like being a columnist. Every subject, I think, right, go on.
You've got an anecdote. You've got a story to match.
Well, I've either got an anecdote, or as a journalist, I find the latest thing on that.
Brilliant.
So you're doing business ethics. Well, Starbucks has just announced that it's going to pay for the college education of its employees. That was yesterday's story. It's directly relevant to what we're learning.
Perfect.
And so I love doing that.
Yeah, and it's a movable feast as well.
Yeah.
Every day, new stories, new innovations, new things for you also to, poke pins into as well. That's fantastic. Now, I lived in Switzerland for 5 years. As in Finland and the other Scandi countries, teachers are paid well. It's a high status profession. You know, teaching the precious young citizens of the future. It's properly valued, it's properly rewarded. Why are teachers so badly treated, badly paid in the UK? I know, groan.
What do you think?
I mean, how have we mucked it up so badly?
We have mucked it up very, very badly. Maybe, Katie, you should say why you think that they're so bad, and I will offer a little ray of hope.
A little ray of hope. I mean, I don't know why. I don't suppose any person believes they shouldn't be better valued than they are. And yet somehow we've ended up here. I mean, historically, as you say, compared to somewhere like Finland, it's not such a high status thing, or Singapore, you look at. I don't think that exactly means that the status is low. And I know Lucy would talk more about that. I think people have huge respect for teachers, but it is often seen as a job that's incredibly tough, that, you've got to be a bit of a hero to do
it. But it's like nurses, lots of respect, but no, we're not going to pay you.
But we're not, so that the pay has traditionally been low, although it's a bit better now than it was. But then people see all these programs on TV, managing classes like managing a zoo.
Yeah.
Who would want to do
herding
that?
Herding cats.
Yeah. So I think that behavior in many schools across the country has improved a lot. Pay has improved. So I think that the underlying conditions in some ways are getting better. But what is so fascinating to me is the whole status question for me and my peers is completely different to what it is for 22-year-olds.
Right.
I did a little survey of the 120 people who we've got on our program and asked them whether they thought that their worth in the eyes of people who knew them had gone up or down as a result of becoming a teacher. And the overwhelming majority of them said that it had gone up, and they had done very high status jobs before. And I think it's because it's almost the sort of, you know, it's the ultimate thing to do, to say, right, I'm post-status, I'm no longer interested in earning lots of money and being a senior partner of a law firm. I've done that.
I want to be useful.
So now I want to be useful. And when other people see that, they really respect that. They think, you don't need to do this. You are working so hard in order to do that. And sort of respect goes up. Also, everyone queues up to talk to you at parties because your stories from the front line are so much more interesting than theirs.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. So you've shifted mindsets and you continue to do that and hopefully bring on more and more people who will see the light and think, yeah, I don't need to be a city high flyer just making money for the stakeholders. Yeah.
And what you said is that's absolutely true. That, you know, of course, there's all sorts of problems and everybody knows the funding crisis is... But a lot of the time when people go into schools, they come to us, but they're very anxious about what they're going to find. You know, they've heard stories of sort of feral children, all this kind of stuff. And actually, I would say overwhelmingly, people are positively impressed by, you know...
Yeah, but 50,000, I read on your website, 50,000 qualified teachers left in 2016.
Yeah.
That's a huge number.
Yeah, I mean, we are losing teachers far faster than we are... training them. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to exist. This is a demographic that haven't been targeted, so perhaps it can offer some partial, and it will only be very partial to solutions.
Oh, there's so many of us.
But the challenge is to keep people. That's got to be the most important thing. You have a recruitment crisis if you didn't have a retention crisis.
Well, we've got what is it, a million over 50s through roughly 64, women especially, 55 through 64, are the biggest slice of the long-term unemployed here in the UK. And it's, you know, it's not because they don't want to work, but finding the access points. You're giving a structured route back into something that is purposeful and that probably a lot of people can do if given the proper support.
And in particular, if given the support of one another. I mean, I think the single thing that now teachers find important is each other. The kind of sense once they begin it that they're doing with a whole lot of other people who understand what it is to perhaps lose your professional identity, and that for a lot of people is really tied up in their personal identity, and you start all over again, and by definition you're really bad at what you're doing to start with, and you're the sort of, hierarchically speaking, at least you're the least important person in the school, and that's strange, but at least they all get it and they sort of have each other.
But how exhilarating to start on something new and test yourself in new environments. I mean, I think that's intoxicating.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And shedding your own status is very liberating. So, you know, in my old job, I was expected to be really, really good because I've been doing it for that long. And people were supposed to respect me. It's lovely when no one respects you. You know, all you have to do...
You have to make your own way and earn the respect of colleagues.
And it's easy to get better when you start off so bad, too.
No way but up.
Yeah, there's no way but up. And that's also so liberating. And you know, nobody's looking at me. I'm a newly qualified teacher. So if I manage to do something well, that's absolutely amazing. If I don't, well, you know, I'm learning.
Yeah, and that's, you know, only you probably know that you mucked that up. I mean, the kids may have called you on it, but nobody in the hallways and none of the hierarchy. You just know, okay, messed that up, must do better tomorrow.
Actually, there's a law of teaching that says just as soon as you're edging your way into a truly cataclysmic lesson, the head teacher will randomly wander in to see how you're doing. And then the next lesson, when you've done something that is inspired, nobody's there to witness it, apart from the kids, and that's quite a big apart from.
But it is actually quite a scrutinised profession.
Yes, it is.
And I think that's a surprise to some people, the idea that you're not just sort of on your own and doing whatever with the kids. People are in and out classrooms.
More terror here.
Yes, yeah,
more terror.
But actually you get used to that too.
And then it can be sport.
And then you sort of think, okay, all right, the head did wander in and I was looking a bit out of control and that was all a bit shambolic. But I feel much more confident about that than I would have when I was 22. I think, fine, what are you going to say about it?
Yeah.
If he wants to talk to me about it, I'll say, yeah, wasn't a particularly
great
lesson.
Well, that's the thing, at this age, you know how to manage all kinds of things. You've been there, you've done it. Your perspective is longer.
I went home from my first year of teaching crying most days because it was such... And if the head had walked in, that was it, I'd crumbled and I was never going to be good at anything, clearly.
So I have never cried... I have not cried once in nearly 2 years.
Even privately alone at 10 at night when you're marking papers?
No, I have not cried. And I haven't even been close to crying.
So at the end of every day, you're skipping out the door?
No, but I'm not crying. I'm kind of thinking, blimey, I'm knackered. God, that was a difficult day. But I'm not sort of crumpling into tears in a way that I would have when I was 22. I think, okay, that was a difficult day. I don't think I did that very well. But, you know, tomorrow's another day. What I'm trying to say is that if you are in your 50s, you know, I think we're much easier on ourselves. We are much more confident. We're easier on ourselves. And we think, okay, I'll get there eventually.
Yeah, and we also have that thing. It's been studied to death. We have better emotional regulation. We don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah.
You also have more perspective on the... I mean, you know, at 22, I had nothing else really. I mean, of course, I had friends and all that, but I didn't have responsibility. You've got your children. You've got your... You know, there are things in life that are more important than your job. And that probably helps, I imagine, the comparison between the two of us in our first year of teaching. This was sort of all I was, in a way.
Is it still STEM subjects only and then languages?
No, we take all subjects... But we specialise in the subjects where the shortages are worst. So that is sort of STEM, languages, a bit of geography. But we also take people on English and history and the subjects that aren't shortages. Because in truth, really great teachers are in short supply everywhere and always will be.
Oh, right. Well, that's heartening to hear. Because I kept thinking, STEM, oh, my word.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Right.
I mean, I flunked completely at math. I was thinking as I was looking at your website and reading all of the reviews of what you do, is there potentially a path with Now Teach for people to become teaching assistants?
I guess there could be. And in fact, some people who've come to us, done the application, spent some time in schools, and then thought, hold on, this isn't for me, have done exactly that. Who's volunteering in a school or...
But are there paid positions as well?
There are paid positions. Yes. There absolutely
And they could
are.
Get, they could qualify. They need qualifications to do that, right? Or no?
No.
Just to get back to how brutal it is, you know, before Brexit devoured all else, education stories were always front page, top of the news bulletins. To an outsider, someone outside the system, it's under relentless scrutiny. The goalposts always seem to be about to be moved or have been moved. It must be incredibly draining when you're on the inside, just trying to do your job. Is that what you found?
Well, I think that we get this barrage of news about how teaching is just completely impossible. But the perspective of the Now Teachers is interesting in this because a lot of other jobs are completely impossible too. And so it's not my feeling that teaching is uniquely under pressure. I think at least teachers aren't frightened that they're going to be fired all the time, which are the sort of pressures that people in other industries have. So I'd like us to slightly change the story about, and I think it becomes self-fulfilling too.
Right.
There are too many stories about the pressures on teachers and it all being completely awful.
Well, you shudder and think. You see, and unruly kids, the feral children, you know, how do you control a class? You see them when they're mobbing the local newsagent.
I mean, I think that the trouble is that teachers are quite a sensitive lot. So if you say teaching is fantastic because you get 13 weeks holiday a year, teachers get very cross because the terms are so tiring. You really do need that time to recover and sort of, you know, regroup and maybe do a bit of planning for next year.
And people just think it's a lark. You know, look, they get all that time off in summer.
And it
it's barely a job.
Isn't, but even so, I think we need to come to a place where we say, actually, okay, you do need it to recover, but in terms of your whole life, 13 weeks holiday a year is a jolly nice thing to have.
Yeah, I think that's definitely.
Recharge batteries and all of that. I'm curious too, having lived in the UK for quite a while, we've had years of austerity. What about the infrastructure within the schools? Does that wear you down? And I taught a creative writing course to kids and it was 1999 and I was shocked. Cast off furniture in staff rooms and chipped mugs. And I just thought, oh, this is a really uplifting place to be.
Yeah, I mean, the chipped mugs that you have to provide yourself and wash up yourself are a bit grim. I'm lucky in that I'm in an academy school that is relatively well funded. So I'm not under pressure to count every single sheet of photocopying paper. But Katie, you probably had a more typical experience.
Possibly studying in terms of the photocopying. I remember getting my worksheets down to some Bradley postage stamp size so that you could produce
use up too much ink or paper.
Too much paper. I think there's huge variation in schools. Perhaps people don't realise quite how, you know, some of them you walk in and it feels really quite smart and grand and others not. I do think the cuts at the minute, by all accounts, the people trying to run schools now are under such funding pressure. You know, you hear all this stuff about head teachers doing the cleaning the loos as well. And I think, you know, something's not working quite right with funding. But I think nobody would go into teaching. You know, we're always, I'm always amazed.
You can buy your own coffee mug.
Fountains and art and this, that, and the other, and you think, well, I suppose, but it's not really what matters.
Yeah. No. Okay. So you look beyond all that. And what about your own funding? You're a social enterprise, Now mm-hmm. Teach?
So initially we were philanthropically funded. So we raised money from various different generous people who thought there was something in this idea and took a leap of faith with us. And more recently we've been given a government grant because we seem to be finding a sort of seam of people that haven't typically gone into teaching.
Well, you're hitting all the right notes, young, middle, old. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's across the generations. I remember listening to an interview that Esther Ranson did, and when she set up Childline, she was overwhelmed, inundated with offers of money, money, money. When she set up Silverline, crickets. Mm. Nobody was digging into their pocket, no philanthropic offerings whatsoever. So you've got it all with the people that you're going to find funding. And it's great to hear that the government has stepped in and recognised that what you're doing is really worthy.
Well, I mean, they are so desperate to try and recruit teachers that anything anyone can do is very welcome. And as Katie says, you know, a few people had set out to try and interest older professionals. No one had managed it until us, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, brilliant. And I'm curious, because a lot of the time on The Big Middle we talk about ageism. Have you experienced any of that?
In schools?
In the schools. Now that you're a teacher of a certain age, you're what now, 58?
9.
59.
Yeah.
Oh, happy birthday.
I'm 59. I mean, I'm ludicrously old in the school, so it's not exactly a matter of ageism, it's a matter of open your blinking eyes and spot the difference between me and colleagues who are younger than my kids. So I do stick out hilariously, but that's just by virtue of what I look like. I mean,
but you're probably, knowing you, reading you, knowing you through your column and your Listen to Lucy audio, well, I guess you called it a podcast at the time, you're pretty impervious to criticism, I would imagine.
Oh, but there was no implied criticism. I mean, I think, no, and the kids sometimes ask me how old I am. And when they do that, I laugh and I say, it's a personal question. I'm very, very happy to answer it if you can give me a legitimate, this was in a business lesson, if you can give me a legitimate reason why it's relevant to what we're studying, I'll definitely answer. Otherwise, I'm not going to. So I sort of play around with them and they think that's funny.
Yeah. Then again, I was 23 and I remember them asking, year sevens asking me how old I was, and I said guess, which was obviously a stupid thing to say, and everything from 40 to 70. So I'm bad at judging age.
Yeah, of course, but they like to know these things,
and
don't
they?
And
I think that the teachers, I think that the fellow teachers think it's hilarious having me sitting in the staff room. I mean, we get on really, really well, and that is so nice.
And you no doubt liven things up.
Well, so sort of I come in, and also I'm much less likely to be towing the line. I'm sort of the naughty one. I can afford to be the naughty one.
And you're kind of saying, why, we need to change that.
Yes, exactly. So I'm sort of doing all of that, and the other teachers are laughing. And so that's those relationships are absolutely delightful.
And there are stories I really like, and I think you had a bit of this in some ways, but where you have a genuine kind of reverse mentoring. So clearly the 25-year-old is the person who knows what they're doing in terms of teaching, and the now teacher is learning. But equally, if that now teacher has been a manager for years and years and the 25-year-old is ambitious for management, it can go both ways.
Yeah, which is fantastic. Really, and that's the way increasingly we want it to work.
Yeah.
We need to have the generations mixing it up, and where better than the natural setting of a classroom in a school?
Yeah. So I'm doing a lot of mentoring of my colleagues on how to help them get senior management off their backs.
Now, a question in turn to both of you. Katie, you know, three years on, since you were cradling your newborns and plotting all of this together, how does what you do now make you feel?
Goodness, that's a good question. I mean, mostly I feel, well, I feel a combination of when I try and step back and I'm dancing with Lucy, we feel proud of what we've done, I'd say. I mean, we didn't expect it would get this far this quick, and it all seems quite surprising at sometimes. When I'm in the sort of day-to-day, I feel mostly as though I'm lurching from one possible crisis to the next, and mostly we've averted them, and that's good.
But when you go home on a Friday night, the overriding feeling is...
It depends what's happened that week. I mean, the weeks are so astonishingly full. You know, some weeks it's all triumphant because you've recruited more people than you'd hoped that week, and, you know, something lovely's happened and a teacher's said that everything's good. And then the other next week's a complete disaster because, you know, the person you just recruited has dropped out and a head teacher's upset, therefore. And
so wonderful in itself because it's... Everything.
It's everything.
It is. Yeah. It's absolutely everything.
Which is what we all want. We don't just want purpose. We want texture in our lives on a daily basis.
And truth be told, when I go home on a Friday, and this is something Lucy and I have talked about, but, you know, mostly what I go immediately into is sort of knee-deep in spaghetti bolognese and the drama of three-year-olds.
absolutely.
You know, there's...
PJ's on.
Yeah.
And what about you? Your word pearls on that, Lucy.
Yeah, I mean, I feel amazement, really. Pride and amazement. You know, back to that day 3 years ago, I had no idea that we would be, as you know, just outside the room where we are now. You know, we've got sort of 15 or so people who work for the organisation. We are hoping to find 120 teachers in schools where they're badly needed for next year.
You've created something from nothing, something valuable and so, for society.
I mean, I feel much prouder of the last 3 years than I do of 30 years as a journalist. As I was just sort of winging it and getting away with it. It was something
that came sort of easy
to me. And, you know, I look back on it and think, well, that was a lovely, fun thing to do.
But it prepared you for this.
But I don't, you know, I feel that it was a privilege to be a journalist at the FT. It was a lovely place to work. But I don't feel proud of what I did in the way that I do now. This has been much more difficult, much more satisfying. My own nascent career as a teacher, I feel very proud of too, because I'm still useless on a lot of days, but I'm miles better than I was, miles, miles, miles better than I was. And it's lovely to know that, you know, 3 years from now, I'm going to be far better than I am.
So full steam ahead, you'll stick at it as long as you can.
Definitely.
There's no going back.
I mean, I can't. I realised that from the beginning. If you make a national news story of your career,
gotta follow through.
You gotta love it. But I didn't love it in the first year. It was too difficult. But I do genuinely love it this year, and that is not only a massive relief; it's a joy too.
Lucy Calloway, founder; Katie Walgrave, director of Now Teach, Encore Careers in Teaching for People in What I Call the Big Middle, 40s through 75. And not that there's a top end at that. You might still be going when you're 80, no doubt.
I hope so.
Listen, it's just been brilliant, both. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The show page is where you'll find the links you need to get off the fence and get your application into Now Teach, which is, as we heard, soon coming to a UK city near you. Another worthy UK social enterprise is Five Aside Chess, sponsor of this week's episode. Five Aside Chess is touring the country in its Battling Suicide bus, forging connection by getting people to put their phones down and sit down and play chess. Talking and laughing with strangers who may well become friends is involved. Find links to all on the show page wherever you subscribe. Head to Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, and of course my website, susanflory.com, to listen to this and earlier episodes. And do follow at The Big Middle Pod on Twitter. Love to connect with you there and on LinkedIn. Until next time, in 2 weeks, see ya.